I do miss the touch. I do miss the sense of touch. I do miss having, it's a huge area that you don't realise that you've got there that is quite sensitive. And it extends around your back and everywhere now. So if I'm touched on the back now, it gives me the kind of a shiver. There's a memory there of how far that did extend. And I miss it. I really do miss it.
1 in 11. Stories from women surviving breast cancer.
Kay was actually 3 years.
That was November 1999.
You were diagnosed in 2000.
99.
So it was practically 3 years.
It was in the shower. Like so many women say that they find it. I was washing myself and I was suddenly felt something that I didn't think had been there before.
I know Mammy rang and told Kay because I was going to drive up, but I just couldn't even get in behind the wheel of the car. And
it wasn't actually a lump.
But I don't
mean that I imagined a lump like a pea or a golf ball or whatever.
So Mammy rang and told Kay, which is not exactly the way we wanted it, but
it was a thickness. It was.
It's just the way it happened.
It was a thickness where the flesh would usually be soft under the nipple. It wasn't. There was resistance, if you like, to your hand rather than just the soft feeling. So there was a thickness there.
Why the hell didn't you tell me I'd get this? Well, you mightn't have got it.
And she was right.
First thought is no.
The oncologist saying to me it takes 3 years for the chemo to actually go out of your system.
I'm imagining things.
So therefore it's nearly 3 years before you're fully back to what you were before. Because, I mean, I suppose technically it kills all the cells, good and bad. So you're down to a rag doll, basically, and you have to kind of build yourself up.
Because my sister had had breast cancer a few years previously.
Yeah. 99, so it was practically 3 years.
For 6 months to a year after she was had gone through everything, I was always checking myself and wondering, was this something? And then you check it again and no, there was nothing. And I rechecked it. And I kind of spent that day checking it on and off and wondering, was it or was it not?
I have to say, I think I found losing the hair worse.
So that was the first, my first inclination that there was something.
3 years is over. I'm beginning to get back to what I consider normal.
Might be something wrong.
And then you can't, okay, fine, here we go again.
Yeah. I went to the GP then, again hoping. Every step you go, you hope that somebody will say no. I actually went into him and I started to cry. And he thought I was depressed. He said to me, are you all right? He says, is it depression? And I said, no. And I managed to tell him what was wrong. He said, here, hop up, have a look. And he said to me, I think, he says, it might be nothing, could be nothing, but we better get it looked at.
Catherine is 52.
But I was just stunned because even though Anne had had this and I spent a time thinking, would I get it? Part of me actually never really believed that I would get it.
I was quite fit. I had never been so fit. I was playing tennis 3 times a week. And I noticed before Christmas in October, my ankles would swell like you would when you're pregnant. And no matter what I did, I didn't seem to be able to get them to go down. So what prompted me in the end to do something about it was I came off the tennis court and my lower legs were still swollen. And I reckoned this was not a good thing.
Deirdre, aged 53.
My elder sister, before she was diagnosed, she had mentioned to myself and my other sister that her legs were swollen. And it was 2 months later she was diagnosed with cancer.
It was February and I went for a routine mammogram. And a couple of weeks, maybe 10 days or a couple of weeks later, an envelope came through the letterbox. And for some reason, I was very suspicious even as soon as I saw the envelope.
Elizabeth is 55.
So I opened it and I was being recalled for another mammogram.
I felt very, very tired leading up to my diagnosis.
Claire is in her mid-50s. 75% of all breast cancers are in women over the age of 50.
There were times where I just had to lie down and sleep, which was very unlike me at that time. But I felt something was coming, yes, something bad.
Looking back, I had felt vaguely unwell. Nothing I could pinpoint.
Susan, now 46.
We were on holidays in France and it was particularly hot. I remember going for a shower in the middle of the afternoon because basically to cool off. and finding the lump. The others were over at the swimming pool playing away.
Baya had a necklace on and I just felt my necklace, just was playing with my necklace, and my hand just went down further. It was a long necklace and I just kind of probed against the lump.
Marie, 39 years old.
Sitting on the sofa on a Saturday afternoon, reading the newspaper, reading the Saturday supplement, and just sitting there with a cup of tea and lounging on the couch on an ordinary Saturday afternoon.
Christmas lights were up all over the place and all the rest, and we were about the last to be seen. The breast clinic at that stage was in this big, big room. So when we walked in, it was a bit nerve-wracking. The room was full of women. It was like a big school hall or something. So we sat there really just waiting.
It was before March the 17th. It was March the 16th because I know it was before Paddy's Day.
I was completely convinced that it was a cyst. I didn't believe for one minute that it was cancer. And I sat in the room and the room was absolutely jam-packed. It was the Friday clinic. I'm pretty sure at the time I felt I was the youngest person there. And there was a lot of older women there that I felt I had absolutely no connection with. And I really didn't know what I was doing there.
And it was a fine, bright day. And I had no qualms about going in there. I was quite lighthearted about the whole thing. In fact, I went in and I thought the place could do with a bit of livening up. Of course, I tried to make conversation with other ladies sitting in the waiting area and waiting to go in, and everybody was awfully quiet and serious.
In the waiting room, there were about 8 or 9 women, from what I recall, and it became obvious that we were all callbacks. We were called sort of one at a time, and at any stage there'd be 3 or 4 people in the room, and it became obvious that some people were being let go after the mammogram. And then all of a sudden there might have been only 5 of us left.
But it was a beautiful day, I remember. Sun was shining and all of that. And
it felt very strange because spring is an opening up time. Everything is, you know, blooming. The daffodils are out and everything else. But your life at that point is on the wane.
When I was called in to be examined, to do the mammogram, I couldn't get over how cold the room was. It was freezing cold, and here was I bare-chested, you know. So I was joking with the nurse. I said, I think, you know, you should all be made to go bare-chested as well if you're going to be making us come in here cold, jokingly. So that was fine. It went through, and the nurse there is obviously fully trained. She takes you. Now, I have a lot of friends who hated the idea of going in for a mammogram because they obviously, they're very self-protective about their bodies. I'm not that precious about mine. I'm quite happy to have people touch me on that, but I know that a lot of people go in, face this as an ordeal thing, and they're told that it hurts and all that. Now, I'm not saying it's the most comfortable thing in the world. The machine is like a sandwich maker in a lot of ways. You know, it has 2 sides to it, and you literally have to try and get as much of your breast into between these 2 plates as possible while she squeezes it as, you know, as close as possible, because she's trying to get all the views possible.
The impression I got after having the mammogram done was that everything was okay. The ultrasound seemed to be clear as well, and the biopsy was taken as a precaution.
Some were called for ultrasound, and then some more were let go, so we were thinning down considerably, and eventually I was called back for a biopsy. And I think out of the original maybe 9 women who were there that morning, only 2 of us were actually kept, so to speak. And I do remember the last woman to leave, who had got the all clear, she was walking through the radio room and she was trying not to yippee at the 2 unfortunates who were left behind.
They see the flat skin,
yeah. Rather than
based, you know, like the way you lean forward, well, your breast kind of hangs from you. Whereas this, you lean forward, it comes like you've got a breast to stay here, and then you've got one that's hanging.
Yeah, you have to do the bend forward trick, you know. So we sat there really just waiting.
I have to say, I think I found losing the hair worse. I mean, I'm not saying losing the breast isn't terrible, but it's kind of not obvious.
And they said malignant tumour, because it didn't click with me. I was expecting to hear the word cancer. And even though I know what a malignant tumour is, when they said it, I didn't automatically associate it with cancer. So I was there saying, you know, what is wrong with me?
Whereas when the hair came out, it was obvious. Yeah. Everyone said, well, that's a sick person. Mm. You don't want to be labelled in a way a sick person.
No.
What they said to me was that there was something, there was a growth, and it was under the nipple of the breast. So they would have to remove the total breast. They'd have to do a total mastectomy.
No, you don't. I'm watching it actually the other night, Desperate Housewives at the moment. I'm a fan of Desperate Housewives, and one of the characters has cancer and she's getting treated chemo, so she's bald, she's lost her hair. And the episode before last, she pulled her the wig off and stood there bald, and I still looked at it and it still gave me that, you know.
It used to come into my head, my God, one of you is going to be gone in the new year.
When it pops up in television programmes like that, you
or
know.
When it was on the Sex and the City.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
The girl Samantha.
Yeah.
We left, we got out to the car, we sat in the car for a bit and cried. And
Catherine had her mastectomy in January 2000.
Because even going off to the hospital, even though I had a sense that something was going to be wrong, I still thought once I went there, everything would be all right once I came out, you know. So we had to drop in to get bread and milk and something for the dinner. And we got there and we parked the car and Paul said, do you want to come in with me? And I just couldn't face the idea of going into a supermarket where people were buying ordinary things, everyday things. Well, I remember sitting there watching the Christmas lights twinkle and think, they're going to cut, you know, just the very idea of it. They're going to cut off this breast after Christmas. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, you know.
Marie was told she had cancer 4 years ago at the age of 35.
My surgeon came in and he had a breast nurse behind him and he gave me the news. But I just couldn't take it in. It was very hard to... I just remember on the day he actually had a tie and there was Donald Duck all over his tie and I just stared at Donald Duck and I just couldn't take it in because literally you're told and then they start talking about surgery and chemotherapeutic options and radiotherapeutic options and it just... You just feel like this has absolutely nothing to do with me. It's just the most surreal feeling. And you leave with a book. I mean, there's a booklet thrust into your hand and it, I mean, this isn't the title, but it's something like, so you've got cancer, but you think, you know, you're walking out with this booklet and you're just thinking, you know, I walked in here. Your life just changes literally in an instant. I had left work that morning to go down and I came back. I know some people kind of retreat into themselves. I just went in and I just start to tell everybody instantly. And I start telling everybody, I've got cancer. I won't be back and work for 9 months is what they told me. I'm going to take 9 months off. So I kind of went into this mode of organising, you know, well, that's it now. I've got to leave work now. I need to start getting my leave in place. And but then they sent me home. So they sent me home that day. And I actually went to my sister because I couldn't face telling my mother because I knew how upset she'd be.
In 2006, Susan had her left breast removed.
Chit-chatted to the surgeon. He just looked at where the biopsy had been taken, made sure it was all okay and seemed very relaxed. And I got dressed again and sat down and just waited for him to tell me that that's fine. Maybe we'll check up on you next year or whatever the procedure was going to be. And to my shock and horror, he said, we've checked the biopsy and unfortunately you have evidence of cancer. I remember fumbling for my phone to try and ring my husband. The breast care nurse brought me to a little room and I sat there. She got me the usual cup of tea, whatever. And let's just say the air turned blue around me with my language. I was just was mad as hell, cursing and swearing and crying, and I just wanted my husband there. My world had just kind of imploded and I just couldn't operate.
Deirdre, a double mastectomy, the summer 2006.
Got the bad news and I went across the road, of course, to meet him and trying to pull off a fast one. I mean, acting should have been not one of my professions, but this is how to go. I said, I was grand, yeah. Did they find nothing? They're not sure yet. I can hear myself now. I sounded so stupid, you know. And so we were actually driving home after. I said, they have found something. They want me to have a bilateral mastectomy. And he kind of said, what does that mean? I said, it means that they want to take away both my breasts.
Claire had immediate surgery the end of March 2004.
They said it was advanced breast cancer and I would need surgery first, a full mastectomy on that left side. Also, all my lymph glands would have to be removed, and it's best to do it as soon as possible. Your first reaction is, well, there is something wrong with me, the fatigue, the not feeling well, the blurred vision, all of the kind of strangeness, the nightmares, all of these things that have been disturbing you, that you have been validated in some way that there is something wrong. And there is a kind of a weird relief in that. And then the horror that you're going to have to part with literally part of your body, and a part that's very significant for women, breasts which are associating with life, fertility symbols throughout the ages. Every culture adores the vital and fertile naked woman, and suddenly you're going to be somebody in a way who's going to be maimed and invaded in a way that you really hadn't thought about before.
I remember a friend asking me afterwards, she says, do you have to wear granny type bras? And whereas they are improving, they're still not. You're not going to get any of your flimsy flouncy or nice bit of colour, or if you felt like having a red one or a pink one with black on it or whatever.
Even a swimsuit.
Yeah, you have to go. You should see them. They're really exciting.
And I mean, they're so dear.
Yeah, I got one there a few years ago.
They're 90 euro.
Yeah, I'm sure people look and say on the beach, my God, you know, did she borrow her great granny swimsuit or something?
I mean, they're not exactly
most... they colour them up and they make them look nice, but they're still, you know, you're up here and you're down here and, you know.
I couldn't actually contemplate it. How are they going to do it and what's it going to look like? And, oh, you know, you get nearly horrible images in your head.
It's just kind of like when you walk around like that, you kind of say, oh God almighty, I mean, they've done this to me and now they won't even give me something that I can feel.
Nice.
And even the weight of the prosthesis.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I think I remember putting them once on the weighing scales on the kitchen. It was just one day, I think it was 2 pounds or something.
Images of somebody actually taking a knife to you and removing it, and what's it going to look like afterwards, and where do they put it?
It's funny, like even looking around in shops, you're kind of, oh, that's nice. No, that's too wide a neck. You know, the scoop circular necks, you can't wear them.
No, you can't wear them.
No. A wide V-neck, you can't wear them because it's kind of, whereas you'd be flat here, you've kind of gone in a bit here.
One of the worst aspects of the whole thing was telling people. It became an absolute endurance test because every single person you told went, oh my God, what? They were horrified. So you were like this sort of bad fairy going around spreading all this awful news.
It's the thing that upset me most was having to tell them. I wasn't as upset telling Peter or telling the boys because it was just, I felt I was telling these women who were in the same boat as me, really healthy, having a great time, living life to the full, and I'm cutting them off at the knees basically, or telling them, look, you want to be careful, you could get cut off like this. I mean, it was just incredible. That's how incredible it was, and I just couldn't tell them.
I couldn't actually bring myself to tell any of my family. I just wasn't able to, basically.
The eldest in the family is 10 years older than me, and then there's two in between, and then there's myself.
I suppose I actually do like being the centre of attention. So here I was, centre stage in my own drama, and nobody could say anything against me. People could not listen to me. People couldn't, you know, everybody had to pay attention to me. So there was a few moments where it was kind of interesting to be able to shock people or to be able to say those things.
And my husband, God love him, had to do it, for which I'll be eternally grateful. He rang round a few of my relatives and got them to tell the rest of my family and told a few friends.
My eldest sister reacted very well, although shocked, as did the next eldest to me. She was shocked, whereas one sister really lost the plot slightly.
And that's one thing I just found impossible to do, to actually say the words to my family or to my friends. I mean, I don't think I've actually, funny enough, I don't think I've actually said it out to anybody who hadn't been told previously, I have breast cancer. And I was absolutely adamant. I didn't want anybody's pity. Their support, yes, but not their pity. This was something that happened to me, and if they could do something for me, well and good.
One sister really lost the plot slightly. She kept saying, what? What? breast cancer? What? And I really felt like smacking her one just to stop her because she wasn't making me feel any better.
I wanted people not to be panicked. I was working very hard to keep everything calm for my kids and to keep things normal for my kids. I didn't want to be surrounded by drama.
People love drama and people do love the drama of it. So not only did I enjoy it, but I know a lot of people loved the drama of it. Oh, did you hear what happened to Marie? And it's like, oh my God. And there's this big, big drama surrounding it. But again, it's like the tabloids. It's like the celebrities. That's yesterday's news. And a month later, you can't shock anybody. They're like, oh, you still have cancer? Oh, right, okay. Oh, no, we're actually going to have to listen to this. We're going to have to see her go through. You know, it's not funny anymore. We have to see her going through the whole, you know, sick and the hair loss. They move on, but people move on and they get tired of it. And they're not interested in your drama. Pretty quickly, people aren't interested in the drama of it all. So that wears away pretty quick.
What happened in that scene? Do you remember when she first of all heard she'd the breast cancer when she went in to get a boob job, she discovered. And then she started on the chemo. And it was when she was sitting in a restaurant talking to them. And she just did this and the hairs were all here. And then she went back to her place and she just got the razor and shaved it all off. Because I remember there was, when I was in the hospital at the time, there was some people and they wouldn't do that. And kind of like some of them were wearing scarves. And when they take the scarf off, there'd be a big bald patch, there'd be a string of hair, there'd be a bald patch. And you were kind of saying, please just shave it all off. Mm.
And then I had got the wig beforehand because they recommend that you get your wig while you still have your hair. And I had done that.
Whereas if you're halfway, someone's come off, then that'll start growing quicker than this. And then when it's coming back, it mightn't come back properly or come back in. Mm-hmm. But I just found it less traumatic because you get up in the morning and you'd look at your pillow and there's hairs on your pillow. Because even turning into bed at night would pull them.
Yeah, I did try in the beginning to wear the wig over the...
You can't.
Because my hair was quite short, but you can't, no.
It's the most uncomfortable.
There's something cleaner about a bald head.
Yeah.
There's something sick looking about a tuft of hair here and a tuft of hair there. You know, at least if the head is bald, you've made a decision, you've decided this is coming on.
But I found the wigs were uncomfortable enough.
Yeah.
Without hair catching. Mm.
I was trying to wear the wig over the hair and that was driving me mad with the itch and I couldn't know what to do and I was afraid that there might be bald patches that people could see and all of that. So Paul said to me, you'd probably be better off just taking it off, just shaving it off. So he said he'd do it for me.
You came with me when I got my wig too.
Yeah.
We went together shopping for wigs.
Wig shopping.
It's a new form of shopping.
Wig shopping. One I wouldn't recommend, but...
But it does. It helps to have somebody else there to say. Yeah, and even kind of somebody who had worn one.
So he said he'd do it for me. So it was a Sunday afternoon. We went upstairs to the bedroom, closed the door. The boys were around the place doing their own thing. And he shaved it off for me. He just did it. Basically, really. He just started. He cut off all the bigger pieces, and when he got cut off as much as he could cut off, he shaved off the rest of it.
And it's just that next, it's another step. You know, the breast is gone. So when you go to bed, when you're going to bed at night, you take off the bra that has the prosthesis. So that's one bit of you take off and put
then
away.
You take off the hair.
And then when the hair is gone too, you go to bed at night and you take off the bra and then you take off your hair. You know, so you're beginning to wonder... You know, how many bits of me I have taken off.
I can remember when it starts to grow back because it starts to grow back like a little fuzz, like a little stone. The fuzz is like a baby fuzz. It's really, really soft. And you just can't stop patting your hair and you can't stop feeling it and rubbing it. And it's just like spring. It's like the first bud just appearing in spring. And it just feels so wonderful to feel that. And just to see it grow every day. It's like you're growing again. It's like a rebirth.
I never gave a minute's thought to what it would be like to lose your hair, to be very, very sick. I mean, I knew I was going to have to go through chemotherapy, although initially I fought against going through chemotherapy. I tried to weigh up this whole risk-benefit ratio by doing an awful lot of research on the internet and literally by driving myself almost mad and everybody around me mad. For me, I was thinking, do I take that gamble? Do I gamble? Do I not have chemotherapy? And do I gamble that my cancer won't come back? Or do I have chemotherapy and gamble that I won't ever be able to have children? I don't know how much I did deal with the cancer because I was so consumed by the whole infertility question. I don't want to say that I can't because I don't want to say that, but my fertility is very impaired. You know, the drugs have had a very harsh effect on my reproductive system. So it's not impossible, and there's always hope, but I honestly don't know, because I don't know. I don't know.
I've been married for over three decades. I was 20, he was 21. We married straight out of college. We thought we were adults and grown-ups. Yeah, so we've been together a long, long time. The day after I had my surgery, when I was coming to after the anaesthesia and everything else, I asked to be taken to the bathroom, and my husband was there with me, and I just stripped naked. I felt the best thing to do was to look at myself and for him to look at myself and for both of us to accept the way I was from that moment. And that actually was a wonderful moment because it released me from a lot of the anxiety I would have. And I just thought, yes, this is who I am now. A one-breasted woman, but this is me and I'm still here.
My husband, yeah, they're all different, but obviously my husband wasn't a breast man, even when I had my own. So me losing them wasn't going to be a big, huge deal to him. But it was like as it was to me. And with these implants now that I have, it's still not a huge deal to him. He wouldn't mind touching them if he had to, but he'd rather not. He's like that about them, because it's understandable. It's like, you know, a prosthesis. You know, is the idea of somebody of touching. Some people find it really hard to be able to shake hands with somebody with a prosthesis as opposed to a real hand. Yeah, and I think it's probably the same thing. Although it is my own skin that's on them, it's not like a total prosthesis or whatever. But but I mean, that's the way he is, and I can accept that. That's the way he deals with it. Certainly doesn't turn away in disgust or anything like that. But while my mum went through a mastectomy much earlier, like she was 66, so it was back in the 80s. I'd no idea what a mastectomy was until I was minding her before she died. 12 years later, when I saw her naked for the first time, and I realised, you know, what she'd been living with. And I didn't, like, that had never occurred to me. She had a single mastectomy, so she had one breast. Just couldn't believe that she'd lived with this for 12 or 15 years, and I had been ignorant of it, and like that she'd gone through so much. And before I went in for surgery, I got Peter to photograph my breasts out the back garden there, and I said to the boys, I said, look, do you want to see what I'm going to go through, or do you not? I gave them the option. I said, look, if you want to see me, I have no problem. And they decided, no, they didn't want to see me. Now, they might do, it doesn't matter, you know, if they do, the photographs are there. It's not that I want them to be shocked, but I don't want them to be shocked at the wrong time, you know. It's better than, look at me now, this is, you can see me, I'm healthy. This is what I look like. Better than feeling sorry for me, like I'd felt sorry for my mother.
Pretty soon after my surgery, my boy would have been about 4 and a half at the time. My daughter turned 8 pretty soon after, and I remember our time for chatting would be when she was having her bath. I'd sit on the loo seat and we'd chit-chat about various things, and often things would emerge, you know. She'd tell me about any little trouble she had with her friends or whatever. So I sat her down. She was in the bath, splashing away, and I said I had been to the hospital, and the doctors had discovered something in my booby, as we call it, or whatever. And it meant that they were going to have to remove my breast. What do you mean they'll take away? I said, you know, I'm going to be flat on one side. And she said, oh, she said, and what will you look like when you're wearing your clothes? And I said, oh, they'll give me like a false boobie, you know, like a sponge one or a plastic one, or we would laugh about that, whatever it was going to be made of, you know. Because she had some song about Barbie with plastic boobies or something like that. She made some remark, might have been like Barbie or something. I didn't tell her at that stage. I told her that after the surgery, when I was better, I'd have to have some medicine that would make me a little bit sick, and that my hair might fall out. And this was a great source of curiosity. But she didn't seem to be afraid, or she didn't seem to be, you know, traumatised by this information. And I suppose because as an adult you find something traumatic or horrific, it doesn't necessarily mean that a child finds the same things horrific or traumatic. And I actually discovered I have a very nice shaped head. The kids were fascinated. They used to like come and rub my head. And when it started to grow back in, they used to check it every day and see kind of they'd feel it. And it was kind of soft and kind of fuzzy. And they loved rubbing it because it was like, you know, petting an animal or something. They also enjoyed playing with my wig. My daughter used to dress my son up in the wig and drag out the prosthesis and dress him up with the bra and make a complete fool of him. But she enjoyed it.
My son had been away in Spain, and he had an electric razor that he uses to keep his hair short, and he'd come back that day. So I now had the razor back, and I went up to the bathroom and I got an extension lead. And I put down papers on the floor and I took off all my clothes. And first of all, I poured a very large vodka and tonic, which is my drink of choice. And I said, I'm really going to need this now. So I'm there in the bathroom and I'm looking in the mirror for ages. And I'm saying, well, where will I start? Will I start at the front? And I thought, no, that's too awful. I'll start at the side. So once I got started and the first lot of hair fell on the floor, I kind of took courage from that. And I said, well, that's the worst bit over now. So I just kept going, and it was very difficult to do on your own, actually, at the back. I ended up with score marks all over my head. But myself and my daughter were in town one day, and I was wearing my wig. And we were standing waiting to cross the traffic lights, and there were two young English guys standing behind us. One said to the other, well, you know, would you do a bald one if she was bald? Like, would you give her one even if she was bald? And his friend responded, and he said, I don't know, really. Yeah, I think I would give her one even if she was bald. I think I would, yeah. So with that, the lights changed and we crossed the road. Now, I was cracking up laughing, thinking, if only they knew. Aoife said to me, hadn't heard. And she said to me, what were they talking about? What were you laughing at? What were they talking about? So I started to explain. I said, Aoife, they were saying to one another, would you give her one if she was bald? Even if she'd no hair, would you still give her one? Anyway, Aoife started laughing. Anyway, we got to the car and I zapped the car. I looked back. And here were the two young guys coming towards me. They had been behind and they had overheard me explaining to Aoife. And they looked kind of embarrassed. I couldn't resist. So I said, hi, guys. And I lifted the wig. Well, they went, ah! It was so worth it. Aoife was mortified. The two lads were even more mortified. And I just laughed all the way home. I said to myself, now that'll teach you. Be careful what you're saying with an earshot. Like, poor guys. Would you give her one even if she was bald? I couldn't resist it, though. Up came the wig and the two eyes went out in sticks. Oh. I got a laugh that day.
You're a kind of a sounding board for each other. Mm. But I have to say, I mean, as I say, I wasn't sick. Mm. I didn't have a reaction to the tablets. Mm. So I suppose in a way you could say I sailed through the treatment.
Sail through it. It's just different.
But you know what I mean? Yes, as in respect of, yeah. There are a lot of people from the day one that they have, they're so sick during it. I wasn't sick at all.
That never leaves your head if you're told you've advanced breast cancer, you know. It's like a bell that goes off from time to time. You just have to learn to cope with it, and you cope with it. People cope with it in many different ways, you know.
I think she's slightly rose-tinted glasses. Okay, I got physically sick and threw up and all the rest, but she was tired. The big thing about the chemo is, okay, you get your chemo, and in my case, for about two days after that, you're throwing up and then you're tired. But as it builds up, and I think everybody will tell you that. I mean, I remember standing at the bottom of the stairs thinking to myself, you know, I need to get up to the top of that stairs. But just the thought of going up those stairs was like too much hard work.
We went on holidays in July 2007, and I remember swimming in the sea and thinking, oh, I never thought I'd get to this place where I just feel so good to be alive. You know, I have my joie de vivre back. Because you can't, when you're going through that phase, you just cannot ever imagine feeling happy again.
Now, Anne had that same tiredness. I remember her being tired. You know, she may be saying, but...
No, I know you had different things. I think the sickness is a horrible thing because that tires you anyway.
But you've got the
tiredness of the sickness plus the tiredness of the... Whereas at least I only had the tiredness of the treatment, is what I'm trying to say, as in that respect is what I mean.
I
it was easier.
That's physical. I'm still not letting her away with it. I think she was still. It's a big deal when it comes down to it. But you'll all have, everybody has their own things, whatever it is.
I never ever felt like, why me? Why did this happen to me? I always thought, well, why wouldn't it happen to me if it's happening to every second person, or, you know, the neighbour down the road. So I didn't have that, which I think quite a lot of people do have. They feel sort of they've been picked out in some way. I never did have that feeling. I just thought it was unlucky, but there you are. Unlucky things happen, and I'd been lucky up to that.
If you're a 35 to 39-year-old Irish woman, you have a 1 in 300 chance of getting breast cancer.
I just didn't understand what effect it was going to have on me. I couldn't project it. Like that, when I came to Dublin first, I'm from the country, I used to have terrible trouble going home at weekends. I'd be like a bitch at home when I'd go home at the weekends, giving me awful trouble. And my mother said to me, she said, look, just project yourself to being here before you leave Dublin. And it worked. It was fantastic. I'd get there and I was relaxed. So I've practiced that ever since. And like that, going in for this business, while I knew what was going to happen in surgical terms, I had no idea how my head was going to deal with it, because I just couldn't see myself being happy or being accepting my altered state.
That rises to 1 in 100 from the ages of 40 to 44.
And the fear is one of the most horrible feelings. You know, the for me was the fact that I had two small children, and I thought, oh my God, what is going to happen to them if things don't go my way? Their dad is great. They're very close to their dad. Well, they still need a mother. Might be the best mother in the world, but I'm the only one they've got. And we love each other.
And 1 in 50 from 45 to 49.
Having breast cancer, it's not the treatment, it's not the chemotherapy, it's not the surgery, it's not the radiation. It's coming to terms with the fact that you do have to face your own mortality. You have potentially life-threatening illness, and it's a possibility that you may die within the next couple of years of this illness. And although you might look perfectly healthy on the outside and everyone tells you how great you look and you know, how healthy you look again, you still could be dying. And not to be overdramatic about it, but that's a stark reality.
After 50, it's 1 in 30.
It's month by month, year by year, chances of you being cured get better. But there's no guarantees. Until you're like 10, 15, 20 years out from it, you can't be considered completely cured.
By the time an Irish woman reaches the end of her life, the odds will have increased to 1 in 11.
I heard of somebody today whose cancer has come back, and she's a year older than me, and she went through the whole treatment the same time as me. And you feel guilty.
In Ireland, the 5-year survival rate for breast cancer is 72.8%. The European average is 77.4%.
you feel like, I mean, you do feel guilty. You feel like, why am I being given a second chance? You know, it's, they didn't, you know, they did everything that you did. They did the same treatment. They've worked just as hard as you have to get better. And it's just very hard to make sense of it.
In Ireland, 600 women die from breast cancer each year.
Even though I tell her, as her big sister, you know, we're told not to carry things that are too heavy in on the side that the operation's there, because it's not as strong. You're
you
more
see, the
open
trouble is, because I'm right-handed, you just automatically...
Yeah, but still.
But like, as I say, if you're somewhere and there's nobody to pick up a suitcase of off a carousel on holidays, what do you do?
There's always a man there.
They don't care.
You asked.
I'm sorry, I've asked. You're left there pulling off on holidays.
I don't know, I think there's always someone.
But anyway, we agree to disagree on these things.
Disagree.
When you're doing something at a time, you can't always...
No, I know you can't. I know that. And I know it's fine. If I'm going somewhere, I more likely would have Paul or one of my big strapping sons with me to do things. And I know you're not doing that. That's not what I mean. I am not giving out to you, doing the older sister role. But it's just... And it's
your way
of getting through something.
It's not going to make me not do something that I would have done anyway. Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm still the same person I was before. It's not going to stop me doing the things I would have done.